There's an old Cornish litany that runs from ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night, good Lord deliver us. And I like to connect it with another saying, which I heard once from a professor of mathematics, Professor Davis at Northwestern, when he said, "It's amazing how many things there are that aren't so." I've been looking again recently at a book which is one of the most important contributions to modern philosophy. Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. And despite its complicated sounding title and the intricacy of some of the reasoning in it, it's basically an extraordinarily simple and extremely cogent piece of reasoning. And the thing about it that fascinated me so much, and some others, is the astonishing similarity of Wittgenstein's point of view to that of Buddhism in general, and Zen in particular. This was also noticed by Paul Wienpohl, who's professor of philosophy at the University of California at Santa Barbara, who once wrote an article on the subject. But let me quote a passage from the end of the book. "The solution of the problem of life is seen in the vanishing of this problem. Is not this the reason why men to whom, after long doubting, the sense of life became clear, could not then say wherein this sense consisted? There is indeed the inexpressible. This shows itself. It is the mystical. The right method of philosophy would be this: to say nothing except what can be said, i.e. the propositions of natural science, i.e. something that has nothing to do with philosophy. And then always, when someone else wished to say something metaphysical, to demonstrate to him that he had given no meaning to certain signs in his propositions. This method would be unsatisfying to the other. He would not have the feeling that we were teaching him philosophy, but it would be the only strictly correct method. My propositions are elucidatory in this way. He who understands me finally recognizes them as senseless when he has climbed out through them, on them, over them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up on it. He must surmount these propositions. Then he sees the world rightly. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent." I suppose that last sentence is one of the most often quoted passages in the whole literature of modern philosophy, rather reminiscent of Lao Tzu saying, "Those who speak do not know. Those who know do not speak." But as one looks over certain illustrations and images in the passage, the student of Oriental philosophy finds them extraordinarily familiar. The idea of throwing away the ladder after you've climbed up on it, that directly parallels the ancient Buddhist simile of the Buddha's doctrine being a raft to cross a river, to cross from the shore of samsara to the shore of nirvana, from life lived, in other words, as a vicious circle, to the life of liberation. It goes on to say, after you've crossed the river, you don't pick up the raft and carry it with you. You leave it behind. And so in the same way, Zen teachers have often made the remark that all the doctrines that the Buddha taught were nothing in a way but obstacles. The doctrine is sometimes likened to giving a child a yellow leaf to stop it crying for gold. And so in the same way, Wittgenstein suggests that the whole task of philosophy is really to get rid of itself. I mean, in rather the same way the task of a doctor is to put himself out of business. Of course, he never succeeds because people keep getting sick. But if he was 100% successful, he'd lose all his patients because they wouldn't be ill anymore. And so in the same way, a philosopher of this kind is very rarely out of business because there are still always people with what we might call intellectual sicknesses, bothered by fantastic and non-existent problems. And so, too, we can see another parallel, where he says, the right method of philosophy would be this, to say nothing except what can be said, i.e., the propositions of natural science, i.e., something that has nothing to do with philosophy. It's just the same thing when the old Zen masters were asked, what is the fundamental principle of Buddhism? And one of them answered, 3 pounds of flax. What has that got to do with philosophy? What has that got to do with things of the spirit? But you see what it is. It's a perfectly ordinary, everyday remark. I know there was another story rather like this. There was an old master called Goso, and one of his students came to him one day and said, how am I getting on in my study of Zen? Oh, he said, you're all right, but you have a trivial fault. Well, what's that? You've altogether too much Zen. Well, said the student, if one is studying Zen, isn't it the most natural thing in the world to be talking about it? And the master replied, but when it's like an ordinary everyday conversation, it's somewhat better. Now, this may appear at first sight to be a kind of philistinism. If, in other words, the most spiritual discourse that one can have is, good morning, how do you do, nice day, isn't it? Does that not reduce all the great speculations of the human intellect, the great quests of human intelligence, to mere prosaic everyday matters? Well, it depends. You know, extremes often have a deceptive resemblance between each other. Very often, parallels have been drawn between the wisest of men and idiots, or between great sages and children, or between saints and drunkards. For in rather the same way that the highest and the lowest notes of the musical scale are alike inaudible, and yet extremely different, so, in a somewhat similar way, the person who's been through the whole thing, the whole quest of wisdom, the whole study of philosophy, ends up deceptively like a stupid man who never heard of philosophy in his life. You know the Zen saying, when I knew nothing of Buddhism, mountains were mountains and waters were waters. But when I had studied it a great deal, mountains were no longer mountains and waters were no longer waters. But when I had thoroughly understood the whole thing, and arrived at the abode of peace, mountains were once again mountains, and waters once again waters. Something rather similar happens here, because you see, what Wittgenstein is really saying is that there is no problem of life, in the sense in which we ordinarily use that phrase. And that seems an almost astounding affront to our common sense. Life not a problem. We see it as nothing but problems. We regard ourselves in a morning, noon, and night struggle to solve the great problem of existence. And for some people this problem is, why does the universe exist? For other people the problem is, how am I going to get enough to eat? And therefore, when you take it at one extreme or the other, why does the universe exist, or how am I going to get enough to eat? Who can say that life is not a problem? And yet here is this audacious suggestion that what we are bothering about is a ghost. It's something that isn't really there. But you know, when we look at the history of science, we find to what an extraordinary sense science has solved problems by dissolving them. I mean, such things, for example, people have spent years and years and years, hours and hours of thought, trying to invent a mechanical contraption that would be in perpetual motion. Think of the trouble they would save themselves if they'd realized it can't be done. Or they've tried to find a construction for trisecting an angle with a straight edge and compass. And it can't be done. And now it's been proved that it can't be done. And how much trouble would have been saved? Or think again of trying to square the circle. Or imagine, for example, people thinking for centuries that the planets revolved about the Earth because they were encased in crystalline spheres. Now, the funny thing is they knew they were encased in crystalline spheres. Why? You could see right through them. And yet that the whole problem of how the spheres were moved, how there was a primum mobile, an outmost sphere that gave rotation to all the others, has simply disappeared. The spheres are presumed now not to be there at all. And it's much easier to think of the solar system without the spheres. In the same way, people jolly well knew that the planets revolved about the Earth in circles, perfect circles. And it was a considerable shock when Kepler proved that the orbit of Mars was an ellipse. So too, we knew, we were perfectly sure for centuries, that light propagated itself through a mysterious continuum called the ether. And to our astonishment, we found out that there isn't any ether. In so many ways, just ordinary physical science, you see, is an act of understanding the world more clearly by ceasing to ask misleading questions. And exactly the same sort of thing happens, too, in psychotherapy. One of the characteristics of neurotic behavior, you know, is it's repetitive. The neurotic personality keeps going through unsuccessful life patterns again and again and again, and nothing seems to be able to stop him. Now, this kind of behavior is exactly what a Buddhist would mean by samsara, the round or the rat race of birth and death, that is to say, of life as we ordinarily live it. Because it is a round, it is a vicious circle, for the reason that we keep trying to solve problems that are not simply overwhelmingly difficult, but problems that are not problems at all. They only look like problems. And so when we tackle, you see, impossible questions. For a simple example, if you really think it means something to ask why is a mouse when it spins, and then try and find out, it'll never make any sense till the cows come home. In the same way, Buddhist imagery likened this to looking for the horns of a hare or the child of a barren woman, or the beard of a eunuch. And thus, things go round and round and never come out when the question being asked is an absurd question, is a nonsense question. And therefore, what brings cure, healing, say, to a neurotic personality, is the insight that the problem that he was trying to solve was no real problem at all. Now, take for example some of the many ghosts which haunt our minds. We say, for example, that we all have an instinct to survive. And a lot of people thus treat the problem of life as, how am I to survive? And one might almost be a little cautious about relieving people of this problem, lest they should lose the impetus to go on doing their work. But that also, impetus to go on doing your work, is another ghost. We think we are driven, you see. We think that what we do has these mysterious things behind it. Like, for example, people say, we always make our decisions on the basis of a pleasure principle. We always choose in accordance with what we prefer. And of course, when our choice is limited to alternatives, all of which are rather unpleasant, we choose the lesser evil. Now, what does this actually say? We always choose what we prefer is simply another way of saying we always choose what we choose. For there is no way of showing what it is that we prefer except in the fact that we choose it. See, it's very important simply to keep your eye on what is being done and to describe that. And if you describe it clearly enough and well enough, you will probably find that the ghost of instinct disappeared. Thus, you see, when we talk about an instinct for survival, what is this saying? What is the evidence for the fact that there is an instinct for survival? There is no evidence except that, in fact, people survive until they don't. And this is rather odd, because what happens to the instinct for survival when people don't survive? Well, Freud thought he solved this problem by inventing a death wish, a death instinct. But that, too, is something as phony as the survival instinct. And the whole problem is much more simply described if we get rid of both of these ghosts. So, in this way, we find that when we try to explain some kind of behavior, some kind of activity, by supposing that there is a motivating force, a sort of incarnate spook behind the whole thing, what has really happened is that we haven't described what's going on sufficiently clearly. Now, this comes out in another way. When we try to describe anything at all and think that we are describing something that, as it were, exists all by itself, like the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland, whose face just hung all by itself in midair. I mean, supposing we have, we draw the Cheshire Cat, and here he is with his big grin, and we try to describe what goes on here. What is this figure? Well, we get at first sidetracked. We are fascinated by the figure. Our attention is riveted upon it, and we think that that is what we are talking about, all by itself, just up there. And we start to talk about its outline, that it's black, and that the cat has a little wiggly fur on the top of its head, that it has whiskers and a big grin, and so on and so forth. But I ask you, let's account for the fact that it's there. I mean, it isn't hanging in the middle of empty space. How does it happen that this black outline is there? Well, where is it? And then we have to say, well, it is on a piece of paper. And the piece of paper is so attached to a framework that it stays upright and could be drawn on and is sufficiently firm. And furthermore, it is of such a texture that the ink doesn't just roll off when you put it there. And but you see what's beginning to happen is that I'm beginning to describe not simply the figure, but the ground of the figure, the environment of the figure. I should also go on to say that the figure got there through the application of a brush with ink on it. And how did the brush get there? Well, you might say, I put it there. Yes, but let's describe that more carefully. What do you mean, I put it there? What does this I word refer to? Well, I is a human organism, and it does things. Wait a minute. What is this it does things? Describe that more carefully. And what are you going to describe? You're going to describe the organism, aren't you? With all its complex structures. But as you describe those structures, as you describe that organism accurately, you are going to describe another action. You will describe the whole thing in terms of process. You won't find, as it were, something doing the process. As I've often said, we are so bugged by the notion of stuff, you see, stuff acting, stuff doing things. But all that is, you see, is that the world strikes us as being material until we examine it closely. In other words, a distant nebula in the heavens looks like a solid star until you turn a giant telescope on it and you make out the clear pattern of a spiral nebula. Or to the naked eye, a lump of wood looks like a solid and impenetrable mass of continuous matter. But when you start turning powerful microscopes on it and the instruments of nuclear physics, you begin to find out that this apparently solid lump of wood is a whirring mass of electrical charges going on in relatively enormous spaces. In other words, the concept of stuff is a sensation that we get when we haven't examined things sufficiently closely, or when our instruments are not fine enough to penetrate what we're observing. But when the instruments are fine enough, what we get instead is pattern, and pattern is simply a form of behavior, of activity. Consider this in another way. Let's go back to the human organism and ask the question, well, what about its shape? How is it that a human organism is contained? All the organs are kept in by the skin. Well, we will describe, of course, the structure of skin and how it is that it holds together. But then we'll soon find out that we're also talking about the surrounding air, which impinges upon the human skin with a pressure of about 15 pounds per square inch, so that if it weren't there, we'd explode. Now, so the question arises, what is keeping the organism in shape? And we find out that it is not only what is going on inside the skin that keeps it in shape, but also what's going on outside the skin. And when we go on to describe this still more carefully, we discover that it isn't quite correct to say that it is the air that is doing this, or that it is the organism that is doing this. We begin to describe instead what Dewey and Bentley, in their very fascinating book, Knowing and the Known, call a transaction. Now, that is to say, a buyer can't buy unless somebody is also selling. You can't know anything unless there's something to know. You can't eat unless there's something to be eaten. And this fact, you see, is constantly overlooked, that anything in the world, whether it's inanimate or animate, whatever it may be, is there by virtue of being in a transactional relationship, not with something else, but with everything else. In other words, a human being, of course, has ever so many relationships. They're very complicated. And because a person, say we call a doctor, is not only related to his actual work of doctoring, but he may be also a father related to a family, he's a citizen related to a community in other ways than as the doctor, and so on and so forth. And so we begin to imagine him, as it were, apart from his relationships, as a sort of constant, going through all these different relationships and therefore in some way different from them all. But this, you see, creates a ghost. It creates a being independent of all the different relationships in which he finds himself. Whenas, strictly speaking, he is inseparable from those relationships. And we can't eliminate them. We can only describe him fully as the entire whole complex. So that, in other words, every organism could be called the behavior of the field or environment in which it is found. Now, this doesn't mean, on the one hand, that the organism is something pushed around by the environment and is completely passive and inert, and that everything that it does is simply a response to external stimulus. Because, in a way, the organism is part of its environment. After all, it is an object, a process in nature, in the cosmos, just as much as everything in its environment. There is really no way of separating the two and saying that one acts upon the other, that the organism, as it were, shoves around the environment, or that the environment shoves around the organism. Instead of speaking, as it were, in this terminology of doers and done-tos, of attackers and victims, we simplify things considerably just by confining ourselves to a description of what is happening. And as we do this, we get a peculiarly clarified picture of the world without all sorts of ghosts. And it is in this way that we also begin to be able to have some preliminary intuition or sensation of the meaning of the fact that life is not a problem. In other words, not a contest between ourselves and our environment. This conception of life turns out to be basically phony.